The Guardian. In February, the World Bank announced that the global target of halving extreme poverty was achieved in 2010, according to their estimates. They qualified that good news by noting that 1 billion people would still be living on less than a dollar and a quarter a day in 2015, with many lives still highly vulnerable and just above the poverty line. What's been the story of the fight against global poverty over the last decade? What role has aid played? And what's been done to help the poor living in middle-income countries? And what should replace the Millennium Development Goals when they reach the target date of 2015? I'm Lucy Lamble. This is The Guardian's Global Development Podcast, and to answer these questions, we've brought together two of the world's leading economists, Jyoti Ghosh of Jawaharlal Nehru University and Abhijit Banerjee of Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Also joining us are The Guardian's health editor, Sarah Bosley, and our global development reporter, Mark Tran. The podcast was recorded in front of an audience at The Guardian's Open Weekend. I started by asking Jyoti Ghosh what's happened over the last decade to get us to the point where the global poverty target has apparently been met.
Well, can I just qualify that and bring in a little bit of the bad news on the Millennium Development Goals? There are actually three goals in that first one. It's income poverty, it's employment, and it's nutrition. And on the second two, we are way behind. We have failed miserably, actually. In nutrition, there are more hungry people. The idea was to halve the very hungry. We haven't done that at all. The estimates are that we now have more than we did. And employment, we all know that vulnerable employment has increased, that good employment or decent work hasn't increased. So on those two, we haven't done so well. Why has this happened? Well, I mean, there are many views, and I think Abhijit was saying earlier that, you know, finally none of us has any idea. But I think if you had to look at the big macroeconomic story, the countries where this has happened, the income poverty has fallen the most, are the countries where there has been diversification of employment, where people have moved out of low value-added activities.
Abhijit, in your book, Poor Economics, you try to establish which development policies are working well and why that is. What have you learned about the practical steps that we can be taking to tackle global poverty?
Well, I mean, the point of poor economics is that there's not one sort of recipe for fighting poverty. There are just many little things that you can do, and if you do them right, you get somewhere. That doesn't mean that there's something else that isn't happening that's also very important. I mean, but by framing this question to be one about global poverty, I mean, we bring in a whole bunch of uncontrollable factors. You know, what could anybody have predicted what happened in China? I mean, you know, if you look at China, if you told the story of what China is today, you know, a country where 65% of the capital is controlled by the state, the banking sector is entirely state-owned, and sort of ask the mainstream economists what's going to happen in China 20 years ago, they say this is going to be a disaster. So we sort of have all kinds of imponderables somewhere there. And then there is bits we know. And I think what we know is that people who get better health in childhood seem to do better in life. People who get better education, better quality education in life, do better in life. You know, if you create programs that help provide old age security, then birth rates go down, and that has long-term effects which are good. Well, things like that. We know a bunch of those things, which are, I think, if you had to create a sensible policy package for countries, those are the ingredients of it. Now, how much of that's what's been responsible for the current decline in poverty and how much of it's just happenstance, which may or may not last, I have no idea.
Sarah, along with the World Bank's announcement on poverty, the UN recently said that the MDG target on safe drinking water seems to have been met, which obviously was something that was widely celebrated, although there were some caveats as ever. What's been going on with health?
Well, I think health is something of a success story in many ways. But what's happened, I suppose, over the last 10 years is that an enormous amount of money has been put into health. Although I notice, according to Gates, Bill Gates has put in an awful lot himself, it only amounts to about 14% of the total of money that's gone into aid, I think. But it seems that way. And I suppose that's partly because the MDGs on health are so important, you know, and we've got, I think, nearly half the MDGs actually are connected with health in one way or another. So there's this massive thrust. You know, we can see some that are very reachable, like malaria. Everybody knows that the death rate from malaria is going down steadily. There are others where we've got an awful lot of problems, and maternal mortality is, and that's why it's now top of the agenda somewhat because it's just not coming down in the way everybody would like it to. But in a way, we've been very ambitious, I think, with health. These things are intractable. They require an awful lot of money. And we've got some of the way towards them. But I think with money disappearing fast as it is and starting to flatline in areas like HIV, we're going to actually have to think about how we do things more effectively and more efficiently for the future.
Mark, you've travelled widely in the last year and you've been to countries recently like Bangladesh and South Sudan. What have you seen that seems to be working well in supporting those who are living in the most extreme poverty?
I think one of the keys is to get the participation of the community involved that you're trying to help. And I'll just give you an example of what I saw in Ethiopia, where it was a programme run by World Food Programme. They're trying to help smallholder farmers, poor farmers, try to reclaim soil that's been badly degraded. One of the things you have to do is basically let the land recover. You have to leave the land alone for 2 years, especially mountaintops, because it rains, nothing stops the water from just rushing off and not sinking into the soil to nourish the soil. So they have to win the consent of the farmers so that no animals will graze on the land, no cultivation on the land, and then try to recontour the land, build terraces, build other water-stopping mechanisms to hold the water. But in order to do that, you've got to get those people to say, OK, we won't touch this land for 2 years. So you win their consent, but you also have to support them for those 2 years. So you give them food for aid, which is what World Food Programme does in Ethiopia. So consent of the community, which seems like a classic thing, obvious thing to do, but in the past, Ethiopia's tried to do this under the Derg, very authoritarian regime. They tried to do this, and they just told the peasants, right, this is what you're going to do. But that doesn't work, and so you have to win the consent of the community. That's one of the key things. And also, things that have worked. Agriculture seems to be one of the basic building blocks. If you look at the experiences of South Korea, Taiwan, Vietnam, they all seem to have transformed themselves successfully by building on agriculture. And I think perhaps this is the way for Africa to go to build on agriculture. And the opportunity is there because you're going to have many more mouths to feed, a growing population, and Africa has the land on which to grow food.
Thank you, Mark. Abhijit and Jayati, how big a role has aid played in the past 10 years?
Negligible. I do think so. I think the countries where there have been the biggest decline in poverty are the ones that haven't really taken aid. I mean, China's the obvious example. Vietnam is a good example. The countries that per capita have received more aid are not what you would call the good performers in terms of poverty decline. I mean, even in a large number of the least developed countries, the thing that has really helped them is shifting terms of trade. They've had better terms of trade over the last decade. That has provided more resources for governments. And I don't think governments are entirely stupid. They would also like to provide infrastructure to get transport access, including to mothers who are in need of hospitalization and ambulances and provide drinking water and so on and so forth. So I don't think aid is important, no.
Let me disagree. I think where aid has been very important, and I think increasingly so, and that sort of echoes what I think Sarah said, I think where the governments are least good is in finding creative solutions. So to take this example that Mark just mentioned, the question is how do you ensure that that happens in a way that's sort of very credible? And if you are the Ethiopian government and you're trying to implement that, the real worry people will have is, suppose I agree to, leave my land and stay away for 2 years, would I actually get a living for the next 2 years? Or would I just starve or something bad happen? I think it's in that innovative space that I think aid has a real role to play. And I don't mean aid necessarily as being from outside. There is a role for a space where you know, the money isn't immediately tied to either electoral or other immediate imperatives. Money which can be used in a way to fail, if you like. You try something, if it doesn't work, we try something else. That space doesn't exist for most of the governmental money. They often fail, but they don't usually say they have failed, which is the important part. And I think that space is very important in creating innovations. And if you want to go this route of, for example, getting poor communities to have their take on creative solutions to their own lives, that's a space where you really need both a credible and a very apolitical funder, because many of them will fail. You'll need to be able to go back and say, that didn't work, let's try something else. I think that space needs to be created.
Sarah, would you like to come in?
Yes, I was just thinking of Katina, where we had a project that we followed actually for about 3 years, I think, in Katina, didn't we, in northern Uganda. When I visited there, it was very clear that although the government, the Ugandan government, is trying to do plenty, you know, and the DFID was funding the Ugandan government and so on, that just doesn't filter through to a region of the country where the poorest of the poor live. And this is such a remote place. And it's 5 hours' drive from Kampala. So it simply doesn't trickle down. And you get a district government out there, the Sorati district government, that was trying to do various things. But in the end, when you actually go and see what's happening to people, they're living in very basic healthcare, which is my area, incredibly basic, and stockouts all the time, no drugs, those sort of things. And you know that for the government to do anything about it was going to take some sort of massive upheaval and a plan that would take 5 years, you know, and it's just not going to happen. So I think what is interesting, I think you need diverse approaches, clearly, public, private, anything that you can get, really. And maybe we have to let go of some of our, you know, preconceptions, or people like me do. I was interested to hear the other day from somebody at the Clinton Foundation, actually. They were talking about oral rehydration salts and zinc. If you use those, you can actually treat children and probably stop something like 98% of deaths from diarrhea. This has cost 50 cents a time, you know, another one of these low-hanging fruit things. If you got those out, just flood the market with them, private sector, but flood the market with it, you would actually reduce deaths from diarrhea massively. That's a sort of a different way of looking at things from the let's help the Ministry of Health to do something about it.
Let's return to China. Abhijit raised this earlier on. Clearly, we've seen quite a different path and development line in China and East Asia. How important, if we're looking at the global targets and global measurements of poverty, how important has their economic success been in meeting those targets, Abhijit?
Hugely important. I mean, if you take just the raw numbers, China and India is the reason why we reached the targets, and that's it, really. I mean, the last 10 years have been good years in the sense that there are many other countries. Brazil has done better than we expected. Kenya has done better than we expected. Rwanda's done better than we expected. Ghana's done better than we expected. So lots of good things have happened in the last 10 years. But if you look at the just raw numbers, it's sort of the big story is obviously China. That's why I said what I said before, which is the problem with China for us in this conversation, we have no idea how we replicate China. This is sort of sui generis, as sui generis as it gets. And so in some sense, I don't know what the lesson from China is.
Well, let's tease out one aspect there. How important is the strength of the state, for example, in implementing development policies? Should we start with you, JRT?
Yeah, well, okay, let me disagree with Abhijit a little bit. I don't think we know nothing about what's happened in China. One thing we do know is that they've had investment rates of 40 to 45% in 25 years, continuously. Now, if you have investment rates like that, you would be crazy not to get 8 to 10% growth, right? Because there's a kind of capital output ratio. You're going to get the high growth. In a way, it's a kind of classic Arthur Lewis model. You know, you're throwing lots of capital at surplus labor. That's drawing more and more people into diversified activities, which are higher value added. And that is creating a general push up. How do you do that in countries that cannot get this 45% investment growth? And is that also the most desirable way of doing it? I think these are big issues. Also that you cannot focus, I mean, China, even with its potentially large domestic market, that kind of growth, you couldn't focus on your domestic market. You had to actually export to the world. Can other countries follow that in the same way? It's more difficult. And of course, there is the problem that too many people try the same thing, the whole boat sinks because the terms of trade then move against you and so on. So it's not easy to replicate for sure, but I think the broad contours of what happened are something that even development economists 50 years ago would have predicted. If you have 40, you know, half your GDP spent on investment for 30 years, you've got to grow.
Brazil did the same thing and the growth collapsed. If you look at Brazil between 1960 and 1980, it goes at 9% mm-hmm. for 20 years. And then it stops. It just has a crisis, stops, doesn't grow for 20 more years. Why did China keep growing? We don't know.
Wasn't a growth based on borrowing.
But the fact was
external
that...
External borrowing really screws it up.
The external borrowing came because the government in Brazil felt that it needed to expand, not tax people. Why was China so effective in effectively taxing people? That's a question we don't know. I mean, somehow the Brazilians were doing exactly this, very high investment rates, very high growth, and they were doing it in an unsustainable way. Why is a low-income country like China so effective at extracting revenues? It has something to do with the ownership structure of China. Should we have wide-scale state ownership of everything? That's not a recipe that the rest of the world seems to be willing to listen to. So those are exactly the questions. So I don't think I'm disagreeing as much as just pointing out that this it's a unique model. I mean, and nobody else
it's
in the world is about to say that, you know, we should just have wide-scale state ownership of property. We did a lot of kind of balance sheet studies, and when you look at that, including all the ghost companies, something like 65% of the capital seems to be in the state sector, and it hasn't fallen. The whole thing of private sector, et cetera, it hasn't really fallen. It's sort of gone down a little, then gone up a little, if anything.
So let's try and bring this back to the human level for a moment, because this is big overarching questions here. We're talking a lot about low-income and middle-income countries, and Andy Sumner's done this recent interesting research about the fact that perhaps the majority of poor people are actually living in middle-income countries and not necessarily in the poorest of the world's countries. What are we doing about that? Are they getting left behind, the poor in the growing countries?
Yes. One of the things Marx said I think is very important, agriculture he mentioned, but I would say specifically the whole importance of small producers and making small producers viable. In agriculture, in non-agriculture, this is something we've neglected completely. In India, more than around 60% of our workforce is self-employed, even outside agriculture. And self-employed basically means you have hardly any capital, no access to credit, institutional credit, terrible conditions of work, zero infrastructure, and so on. We really have to think about how to make that viable. Smallholder agriculture across the developing world, we've neglected it utterly. I'm sure Mark will have more to say on this.
I think organization is key, because you have to organize them into collectives so that it's easier for them to have access to markets, to processes. And as far as helping the ultra-poor in the middle-income countries, I mean, there is some interesting work done by NGOs like BRAC in Bangladesh. One of the things that they were trying to do with the ultra-poor meaning that these people don't even have access to microcredit, microfinance. So the trick is to get them onto the first rung, as it were. And one of the things that BRAC was doing in Bangladesh was to go to the village and find out, first of all, who are the ultra-poor, because that is sometimes a problem. The people in the village don't even know among themselves who are the poorest in the community. So you identify them, and then one approach was to give them, for example, some animals, some chickens, a cow, and a goat, whatever. And you have to work with these people for 2 years. It's not just a case of giving them the assets and say, okay, get on with it. But you have to teach them how to raise the animals, how to get the most out of the animals. And also what was interesting in the case that I saw was that once the better off villagers realized who were the least well off, they then pitched in to help the poorest in the village. So you kind of instill a group dynamic within the village so that kind of everybody pitches in.
We did actually two impact evaluations of exactly this program, one in Bangladesh and one in BRAC's program, and a replication of that in India. And you see dramatic results. These are people who were living, I think, well below 50 cents a day. These were extraordinarily poor people, mostly women, abandoned women, or women with husbands who were disabled or alcoholics. This was the basic population. And at the end of 2 years, we see them as being, you know, they are eating much more, many more calories. The children are healthier. Their children are more going to school more. They're just generally much, much better off. And so that's sort of the good news. The bad news, I think, is that that's a small part of the population, because partly there is a social consensus that these people can be helped. So if you identify them, people are willing to help them. So there's always kinds of ways in which, if you take the desperately poor, they're actually the relatively easy target if you can find them, which is a problem. But I think the next level of people, the smallholders who are not quite at that level of desperation, that's the bulk of the poor in a country like India or even in China. And that's a set of people for whom the mechanisms are much less obvious. I think that's the sort of the bad news, is that we don't actually know how to make agriculture. We know how to get agriculture be much more productive. The technology is there, but the take-up of those technologies has been a huge problem. We've seen in Kenya, the technologies which have 150% per year return are not adopted. You sort of force them on people, adoption goes up to 35%, and then it goes down to 20%.
So can we alleviate poverty simply by providing better access to information and technology, or do we need to actually be tackling social and political structures as well? Jyoti.
Yes, it has to be the whole thing. There can't be a technocratic solution to many of these things also, because many of the purely technocratic ideas, for example, the whole idea that there are leakages in government delivery, which there are. I mean, we all know that there are massive leakages in all public service delivery. And in India, there's a big idea now that you can resolve it by having identification, unique identification of people, biometric and so on. That's a technology fix to what is basically a social and political issue. A lot of the leakage is a reflection of the political economy. It's a reflection of power in that particular community and the distribution. And that doesn't go away through the biometric identification. There's ways are found around that. So you have to address the whole thing.
Let me disagree with that. I think the general point that we cannot solve all problems technocratically, it should not be conflated with the point that specific problems are much more amenable to solution than others. And in this particular case, I think the identification will still make it a lot easier. If you wanted to transfer money to people, you could do it in relatively effective ways. I don't believe that they are nearly as easy to corrupt as other mechanisms. We need to have technocratic solutions, otherwise we're going to have to wait till the day when the world somehow reforms itself or there's a revolution, and I'm just not willing to wait for that long.
Let's turn now and look at the transferability or not of the work we've been talking about. Abhijit, specifically your research, to what extent is it transferable, say, from something working in India to that work also in West Africa?
So that's an excellent question, because I have a good example. Generally, I believe that if you actually understand the principle of what's going wrong, then it's transferable, and you need to understand that. So in case of primary education, I think one of the things, I think a bunch of stuff we did in India identified was the idea that, sounds inane when I say it, but it's really important, and the educationists don't seem to agree, that you need to teach children where they are, that you cannot teach people who have missed, you know, how to read in first grade, you can't teach them history in third grade. And that idea seems logical, obvious, not implemented. So there's a scheme that we studied many times in India and always works, is just get young people who work with the school system to provide this additional help, which is, if you suppose you're in third grade but you can't read, I'll help you read or do your basic arithmetic so that you can catch up. This initiative, we've evaluated many versions of it in India. It always works dramatically. Recently, some of our colleagues worked with the Ghanaian Education Service, brought a bunch of people from Ghana to India, like an immersion training in what this is. The Ghana has this, I think it's called a civil corps, which is unemployed youths who have had some education are given a stipend for 2 years to do something. So these people were then trained to be helpers in the schools. And we're starting to look at the results from that. And again, you see the same pattern, which is that this creates large gains in learning, especially among the people who didn't have the basic skills. You see quite dramatic gains in learning. So that's sort of a good example.
Let's fast forward now to 2015, when, in theory, the MDGs will all have been achieved. What happens next? What should replace the MDGs on the global agenda at that point? Sarah, what would you like to see?
Well, I think the first question is, you know, is it useful to have targets such as the MDGs? And personally, I think yes. I really do think so, because we've all said that we haven't made the progress we would have liked to have made, but nonetheless, we've made some, and it's been quite substantial in some areas. And I think unless you have it, you just can't hold the, you know, hold people's feet to the fire. You can't get the donors to cough up the money. And however haphazard the whole progress of aid is, nonetheless, you need it to happen. So I would like to see, certainly once we've got there, a rethinking of these targets. But we also need to reformulate them. Probably we still need to do the things, more or less the same goals that we've got now, because we're not going to meet most of them. Reformulating so that, for instance, in health, I've been concerned that sanitation wasn't even in there to begin with, and which is mad. And so you do need to see things a little bit more in the round, perhaps, than you did before. You need to see that if you really do want to bring disease rates down, you actually have to look at the environment as well. So somehow you need to integrate those, but at the same time you need snappy targets, things that are easy for people to make a plan about and to raise money for, actually, to in their country. Need for politicians to say, we're going to beat this, and therefore it's got to be a simplistic target, I'm afraid, in the real world.
Jyoti.
Food security, employment. I mean, the two ones that I described as the failure in the MDG 1, which are hugely underachieved, and which are, in fact, emerging as the big problem across the developing world right now.
I want to agree with Jyoti and disagree.
It had to happen.
I think food security is the wrong word. It's always been the distraction. Because I think child nutrition, not food security, should be the word. The difference is huge. If you look at what's happened in South Asia, you see that at every level of income, going well up into the distribution, food share has been falling. People are spending, at any level of income, people are spending less on food. They're buying more cell phones. They're buying more other knickknacks, more things that are available. They're using choice to move away from feeding their children. I think this is a catastrophe. But if you think of just as being, do I have the ability to buy the food? That's a wrong frame for that question. If you look at the National Family Health Survey in India gives you five categories of income. The middle category of that is sort of like not the poorest at all. It's like the middle of the distribution. The child malnutrition rates in that category compare with sub-Saharan Africa. Sub-Saharan Africa is the poorest part of the world. The malnutrition in the middle category in India is comparable to that. So these are not the people who can't afford food. They could afford as much food as they wanted for their children. They don't buy it. They do other things with their money. And whatever they're doing, we need to fight that. So it needs to be refocused on child nutrition.
That's your priority on the agenda.
That was my 1, 2, and 3, I would say, for South Asia and maternal.
So they're not children, right?
Absolutely.
The ones who are having babies?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I think the whole, yeah. It's all of that whole chain of the perinatal, the nutrition, the mother's nutrition, all of that pattern is a disaster. But you see where the disaster, I think, is kind of 1, 2, and 3. And I think the fourth would be, I think, the falling water table. That's an enormous problem. It's going to create crises which we haven't even thought of yet.
Just in practical terms, to jump in on that, on your 1, 2, and 3, I mean, what you're talking about there is changing people's behavior and attitudes. I mean, this is an educational thing. This is saying to people, don't spend your money on a mobile phone, spend it on feeding your child. I mean, we can't do that in this country, actually.
Deliver.
So you're heading for the NCDs here, the non-communicable diseases, and heart disease, diabetes, and everything else. We'd like to change people's views on how they behave here. I don't know how we do that in the developing world.
I think there are,
if we can't do it for
some
ourselves.
Some technological bits, forgive me, Jyoti. I think there's a whole technology of
I never said you don't use technology. I just said it's not the only solution.
Of course. sprinkles of micronutrients in making them available as free sugar that the family can, with micronutrients built into it, that they can put into everything, will get the children the micronutrients. There's stuff that we could do, which would be put iron in salt. There's a bunch of stuff that you can do that will still help. I think you're right that it's an uphill task, but it's an uphill task that we need to. And this is, for South Asia, this is problem number zero. I mean, there's no question to me. for me.
And Mark?
Well, water table takes us straight into climate change. And the Human Development Report last year said that climate change could derail everything. It could just throw everything out of kilter, or the MDGs will go out of the window if you don't tackle climate change. So that's one thing. And then inequality is probably going to be much higher up the agenda in the next set of MDGs because of what we've seen partly in Arab Spring, where you had countries like Tunisia, which delivered very well on things like human development. All the indices showed that a country like Tunisia was doing well. But unless you took care of inequality, the whole thing can blow up in your face. And success stories like China are now finding the same kind of social pressures because of inequality. So the catchword now is inclusive growth. And so that will be much more prevalent in the next set.
Thank you, everyone. I'm going to pause us there because I think it's about time we heard from our audience. I'm just going to start us by asking a question posed by one of our readers on the talk point on the website. This comes from Garth Luke, who says, I'd like to ask each of the speakers, what is the greatest example of poverty reduction that they've witnessed? So let's start with Jyoti.
Well, it's very clear. The greatest historical example has been happening in front of us in the last 20 years is China. It's historically unprecedented. You know, hundreds of millions lifted out of poverty through a strategy of breakneck industrialization that is impossible to replicate, but is nonetheless an extraordinary achievement.
Abhijit?
I would agree on China, so let me answer a slightly different question, because where have I seen something that has a dramatic effect and seems trivial almost to do? Here's a very long-term study from Kenya. 14 years ago, a bunch of kids in Kenya were given deworming medicine. Medicine costs less than 50 cents delivered. The medicine itself costs nothing. There's delivery. You need 50 cents a year. The kids who had that for 3 years today earn 20% more than the kids who had it for 1 year. Four pills more a year gets you 20% more now. And so that's, to me, a miracle. That's what we really need to look for, is these really easy wins.
Mark?
I think, China, obviously, and the other Asian success stories, and what's the common elements? Protect your infant industries, do not open your markets, do not liberalize your financial sector, do everything that goes against what was preached by the free market fundamentalists. Yeah.
So. Thank you, Mark. Right, let's hear from members of the audience. Who'd like to start us off?
My name is Ram Mashru. I'm a freelance journalist. Human development in the conversation we've had was conspicuous by its absence. It was only mentioned towards the end about Tunisia and kind of inequality. Given that there's a growing consensus that human rights, etc., greater education, gender parity is also a tool in combating poverty, could the panel elaborate on how they see civil and political rights and its development, the role that plays in combating poverty?
Sarah.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, thank you very much for that, because I think that one thing that we should be talking about is the status of women, and that's very much to that point. A lot of the poverty reduction programs, and certainly the health programs that, you know, I'd love to see succeed, are those that do empower women. They usually are the poorest. We were talking before about, for instance, giving animals to communities, and how these are sometimes, you know, the widows. And I wonder whether actually doing that increases women's status. You know, it's not just the fact that they have got something more that gives them more of an income, but it actually gives them, lifts up their status in their community as well. And that helps their life generally. And I saw this, as I say, in Katina in Uganda, that women are of such a low status that they sort of can't get off the bottom level. And I seriously think that we need to tackle that. And that's why I welcome actually the fact that the maternal health goal is so important these days, because that's obviously who it's at, you know, who it's intended for.
Yeah, I don't think we've kept away from human development, because a lot of discussion on health and education is all part of the same thing. But I completely agree with you that obviously women's empowerment is not just intrinsically good, but a critical part of the broader struggle against poverty. And there I would add, I mean, female nutrition is huge. It's not just because of the children. It's because, in fact, a large part of female mortality, maternal mortality, is affected by the nutrition status of the women. That, in turn, leads you to sanitation, because that's a critical part of not just the health conditions, but the unpaid labor involved in for women, the ones who end up doing the procuring, the fuel gathering, the water gathering, the cleaning, etc., associated with lack of piped water, lack of sanitation, lack of access to fuel, typically women with their unpaid work. So since poverty is multidimensional, a very large part of these other dimensions, the basic burden of poverty is borne by women.
Thank you. Let's throw it open to another question now.
Hi, I'm James. I'm an accountant. Nike recently got criticised about its scheme for trying to improve the lives of adolescent girls. I was wondering if the panel had an opinion on the role of multinational corporations.
The background to this is we've just had a review by the ICAI, I hope I've got my acronym right there, who've looked at DFID's support and they've looked at the policies and the accounting mechanisms and so on of the Girl Hub, the Nike Girl Hub, the Girl Effect. There were some criticisms, one of which, for example, was that they lacked a child protection policy in the early days.
Shall we put it this way? I'm slightly cynical about CSRs. They may do a little bit of good here and there. I don't know if, in the end, they contribute a huge amount. The role that any external agency can play, I believe, in poverty reduction is dominantly through providing knowledge, technologies, and new ways of doing things, giving ideas, helping along the process, and perhaps giving a few insights that could be used. I don't think somebody going out there and doing a little project is going to have a big impact on poverty.
You seem to be agreeing.
I'm agreeing.
What's interesting when you go to conferences like the one on least developed countries in Istanbul last year is that you've got a spectrum. The NGOs at one end of the spectrum, they are completely suspicious of private sector. And the private sector at the other end, of course, they're saying what wonderful things they can do in the developing world. But somewhere in the middle, the attitude of the developing countries themselves, they're much more pragmatic. They say, we actually do need private sector. We need corporations to come and invest and employ our people. So I suppose the key is how those governments in the developing countries deal with the private sector, whether they have the requisite regulations on health, on labour laws and all the rest of it. Because it's you need them, but you need to deal with them with a firm hand. Otherwise, they're going to rip you off. And you see that in Ethiopia, where there are big investors coming in now and buying up or leasing up huge tracts of land on really very favourable terms to themselves. And so it's up to those governments to kind of lay down the terms of trade so that they're getting something out of it.
Thank you very much, Mark. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for now. Thank you very much to our guests, Professors Jyoti Ghosh and Abhijit Banerjee, and to Sarah Bosley and Mark Tran from The Guardian. Thanks also to the audience here at the Guardian Open Weekend at King's Place in London. The producer was Ian Chambers. I'm Lucy Lamble, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.